This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Marco Flavio is Senior Lecturer at the Federal University of the State of Minas Gerais in Brazil. He's currently Director of the Brazilian Keynesian Association, the AKB, and a visiting scholar this year at the Department of Land Economy in the University of Cambridge. His research interests include post-Keynesian economics as a whole and economic growth in particular. Jeff Tiley is an economist with the Government Economic Service based in Her Majesty's Treasury. The focus of his research is Keynes, and he's the author of Keynes Betrayed, The General Theory, the Rate of Interest, and Keynesian, unquote, economics. He's therefore particularly keen on distinguishing the economics of Keynesians, like Samuelson and Krugman, from those of Keynes himself, as may prove relevant to this paper. So, with that introduction, over to you, Marco.
I would like to thank Mark Reyes for having invited me to give this seminar. It's a pleasure to be here. And I would like to also to thank Geoff Tilley to have accepted the invitation for to discuss the paper. The paper was written by Philip Arestes and by myself, and it's titled Fiscal Policy and the Substitution Between National Savings and Foreign Savings. There are many studies in the mainstream literature that deal with the relationship between national savings, foreign saving, and investment. And in these studies, savings are prior to investment, and when the degree of the international capital mobility is limited, domestic agents are constrained in their intertemporal choices by the amount of the available foreign finance, and thus foreign saving becomes a determinant of national savings. Although these studies in the mainstream literature deal with open economies, the issue of the re-exchange rate is set aside. The re-exchange rate is not considered as a determinant of savings or of national savings, and it passively adjusts to produce the equilibrium between investment on the one hand, and on the other hand, national savings plus foreign saving. However, on the post-Keynesian economics, investment causes savings, as Keynes showed using the concept of a monetary economy, production economy, and the finance, investment, saving, funding circuit for the closed economy. Thus, how does the post-Keynesian literature address the relationship between national savings, foreign saving, and investment? Is the finance, investment, saving, funding circuit that I call first circuit? Is first circuit valid for open economies? Is there a role for the re-exchange rate as in determining the level of domestic and or foreign savings? There is no such study that shows how the first circuit for open economies. And there are very few studies that are concerned with the role of the re-exchange rate in determining savings. For example, Bresser Pereira and Nakano, Bresser Pereira and Gala, are some of these studies. Bresser Pereira and Gala argues that the appreciation of the re-exchange rate leads to a fall in national savings. As they argue, when the re-exchange rate appreciates, real wages increase, because the price of non-tradable goods rise in relation to the price of tradable goods. And by symmetry, profits decrease. And since the propensity to consume of capitalists are higher than than the propensity to consume of workers, the aggregate consumption rise and national savings fall as a percentage of aggregate income. The argument that Bresser Pereira and Gala present explain why national savings decrease after the appreciation of the re-exchange rate. But they don't explain why the appreciation of the re-exchange rate leads to an increase in foreign savings. So the aims of this work are twofold. show the first circuit to the open economies and its link with the re-exchange rate in order to demonstrate that the distribution of savings between its national and foreign parts depends on the level of the re-exchange rate. That is, investment causes savings, but savings should not be necessarily restricted to the country where investment takes place. The other aim is to show that the government budget deficits do not bring forward a picture where investment is constrained by savings, as it's argued by the conventional wisdom or by the twin deficits issue. So, which are the mechanisms or which are the channels through which the appreciation of the exchange rate increases foreign saving, which replaces decreasing national savings? The answer may be related with national income accounts and with the first circuit in the case of open economies. So, this equation, the equation one, is a well-known savings investment identity that shows that national savings minus investment are equal to net exports of goods and services that are is equal to current account balance that is equal to net foreign investment that is equal to minus foreign saving. And assuming for the sake of simplicity that investment goods are just capital goods, then investment is equal to domestic output of capital goods plus imports of capital goods minus exports of capital goods. And we can use equation 2. In equation 1, we will have replace investment, and we will have equation 3. And for the sake of simplicity, we assume that there are no external transactions on services, and there are only two kinds of goods, consumption goods and capital goods. Thus, if we replace X and M for exports of consumption goods plus exports of capital goods and imports of consumption goods plus imports of capital goods, we have equation 4. And equation 4 shows that national savings are equal to net exports of consumption goods plus domestic output of capital goods. And since from equation 2, investment is equal domestic output of capital goods plus imports of capital goods minus exports of capital goods, we can use this in equation 4, and we have equation 5. Thus, equation 4 shows that net exports of consumption goods are part of national savings. And equation 5 shows that when the current account is equal to zero, net exports of capital goods that are part of national savings are equal to net imports of capital goods, which in turn are part of domestic investment. Thus, assuming that price elasticities for imports and exports are higher than zero, the appreciation of the re-exchange rate leads to a fall in net exports of consumption goods, to a rise in net imports of capital goods, to a fall in net exports, and therefore to a fall in national savings. That is, the appreciation of the re-exchange rate leads to a picture that shows net imports of capital goods without net exports of consumption goods as its counterpart. And since net exports of consumption goods are part of national savings, after the appreciation of the re-exchange rate, this part of national savings is no longer the counterpart of net imports of capital goods and therefore of investment. So, which is the counterpart of domestic investment after the appreciation of the re-exchange rate? The answer may be associated with the proposition that investment precedes savings, and that investment and that savings should not be necessarily restricted to the country where investment takes place. In the closed economy, investment produces income, the multiplier operates, and at the end of the process, we have savings emerge. In the open economy, exports also play this role. When the receipts of exports are used for imports, capital goods, this is equivalent to exports being domestic investment proper. Just as it happens with investment, exports produce income, consumption, and savings. The difference is that instead of producing capital goods to meet investment demand, there will be the production for exports, and the receipts of exports will be exchanged for imports of capital goods, thereby meeting investment demand. After the appreciation of the re-exchange rate, net exports fall, national savings fall and the exchange of exported goods for the imports of capital goods will be at least partially interrupted. So, after the appreciation of the real exchange rate, part of the import of capital goods and therefore part of investment will no longer have its counterpart in national savings. It will have its counterpart in the absorption of foreign savings, that is, current account deficit. And the appreciation of the real exchange rate in the domestic country entails by symmetry a depreciation of the real exchange rates in the rest of the world. So, for the rest of the world, net exports and national savings will have increased after the appreciation of the real exchange rate in the domestic country. And therefore, domestic investment or part of domestic investment boosts savings abroad and not national savings in the domestic country. Equation 5 is a good tool to show this process. We have, if current account is equal to zero, net exports, that equation 4 shows us that is part corresponds to national savings. So net exports and therefore national savings are equal to net imports of capital goods when the current account is zero. But after the appreciation of the real exchange rate, the current account turns into deficit, and net exports of consumption goods fall, and net imports of capital goods rise. So the counterpart of net imports of capital goods is no longer net exports of consumption goods and therefore national savings after the real exchange rate appreciation. The counterpart is the deficit in current account. The current account deficit. Thus, when the real exchange rate appreciates, part of the stimulus from domestic investment to the formation of savings leaks abroad, thereby affecting national and foreign savings. That is, there is a substitution of foreign savings for national savings, as Bresser, Pereira, and Gala argue. Investment causes savings, but savings should not be necessarily restricted to the domestic economy. Domestic investment can boost savings overseas. In the domestic country, the distribution of aggregate savings between its national and foreign parts depends on the level of the real exchange rate. This process and the role of the real exchange rate in determining national and foreign savings can be shown by using the Finance Investment Savings Funding Circuit for the open economy. The first circuit was elaborated by Keynes in the case of a closed economy and is shown in flowchart 1. So there is a finance for the production of capital goods. Since the economy is closed, the production of capital goods is the same of investment, and this entails income at the capital goods industry. The multiplier operates, income grows, and at the end of the process, savings emerge, and therefore there is funding for the finance. We intend to show that first circuit is also valid for open economies. Many cases are possible, of course, but we showed at least one case that is sufficient enough to prove that the first circuit to open economies is valid. First circuit to open economies is more complex because international financial system and international trade are involved with this circuit. So we assume two countries, W and Z, whose incomes are not necessarily at full employment level. Both economies produce capital goods and consumption goods. W exports capital goods to Z, and Z exports consumption goods to W, in a way that both economies show that current account is equal to zero. We further assume that net receipts of factor income from abroad, interest on the government debt paid to foreigners, and foreign transfers are all zero. Thus, flowchart 2 shows the first circuit to the open economy Z. There is a finance for the production for exports. At the lower part of flowchart 2 shows the same process showed by Keynes for the closed economy. And we suppose that at the same time another process is happening. It is showed by upper part of flowchart 2. So in this part there is a finance for the production for exports. The receipts of exports are used to import capital goods, and the production for exports entails income, the multiplier operates, and at the end of the process, savings emerge, and there is funding for the finance. So this is equivalent to exports being domestic investment proper. The difference is that instead of producing capital goods to meet investment demand, there will be there will be the production for exports, and the receipts of exports will be used for imports capital goods, thereby meeting investment demand. So the counterpart of imports of capital goods, which in turn is part of investment, is national savings. And national savings is the result of the production for exports. At the other country, there is a finance for the production of capital goods, and this entails income at the capital goods industry. And to simplify the argument, we assume that all income will be used for imports consumption goods from Z. Then there is no savings in the upper part of flowchart 3 and no investment, because the production of capital goods will be exported. And the exports provide both the funding for the finance and the amount of foreign currency that is exactly necessary to import consumption goods from Z. And the lower part of flowchart 3 shows the same process showed by Keynes for the closed economy. So W and Z current accounts are balanced in flowcharts 2 and 3. What happens with the first circuit in Z and W when the Z's re-exchange rate appreciates? The re-exchange rate of revaluation in Z entails by symmetry a re-exchange rate devaluation in W. The exchange rate appreciation in Z stimulates its imports and curtails its exports. The opposite happens in W. To simplify the argument, we suppose that Z's exports fall to zero, whereas its imports do not rise. Imports from Z drop to zero and its exports remain at the same level. Let us also assume that the levels of investment in Z and W do not change. Thus, flowchart 4 is flowchart 2 after the appreciation of the re-exchange rate in Z. So, the appreciation of the exchange rate in Z entails the end of production for exports. And as a consequence, there is no more an export sectors to bring forth income and savings. So there is no savings. But the imports of capital goods remains unchanged because we assume that the level of investment doesn't change in both countries. So there is a finance at the international financial markets for import capital goods, and the current account turns into deficit. That is, after the appreciation of the re-exchange rate, net exports fall, national savings fall, the current account turns into deficit, and foreign savings rise. In other words, after the appreciation of the re-exchange rate in Z, the counterpart of domestic investment, the counterpart of net imports of capital goods, changes from national savings to foreign savings. And in W country, there is a finance for the production. In W country, the appreciation of the re-exchange rate in Z entails by symmetry a depreciation of the re-exchange rate in W. And we suppose that its imports of consumption goods drop to zero and its exports of capital goods doesn't change because the level of investment doesn't change in both countries. Thus, there is a finance for the production of capital goods for exports. This entails income at capital goods industry, and the multiplier operates, and at the end of the process, savings emerge, and as a consequence, there is funding for this finance. And the exports of capital goods entails a current account surplus. Thus, the counterpart of net imports of capital goods from Z is the exports of capital goods in W, and therefore a current account in W and savings in W. So the counterpart of the imports of capital goods from Z is national savings in W. After the re-exchange rate appreciation in Z, net exports growth in W since its capital goods exports remain unchanged and its consumption imports drop to zero. This is the counterpart of capital goods imports from Z, that is, capital goods exports from W and its national savings, which its net exports bring about, are the counterpart of investment in Z. In addition to this, aggregate investment equals national plus foreign savings in both W and Z countries. After the re-exchange rate appreciation in Z, the stimulus from investment create savings in this country leaks abroad. Domestic investment produces savings. Nevertheless, the latter should not be necessarily restricted to to domestic economy. The distribution of savings between its national and foreign parts depends on the level of the real exchange rate. And finally, we consider some issues concerning the relationships between fiscal policy, national savings, foreign saving, real exchange rate, and current account. The twin deficit hypothesis is normally explained by economists through this well-known savings investment identity. Krugman investigates if fiscal policy drives the current account and concludes that the view that real exchange rates have nothing to do with trade balance is a confusion between account identities and behavior. Although an economy must respect account identities, looking at these identities can never be the full analysis. We must ask how the account identity is translated into incentives that affect individual behavior. There is a widespread view among policymakers that fiscal policy affects the trade deficit directly rather than through the channel of real exchange rate change. Also, Krugman points out that in the standard view, fiscal imbalances work through the real exchange rate. A budget deficit leads to a real appreciation of the real exchange rate, which reduces the competitiveness of a country's industry and thus leads to a trade deficit. McKinnon has argued strongly that the real exchange rate needs to be changed to adjust the trade balance only when an economy is insular, that is, closed to capital movement. He argues that when capital is mobile, savings investment gaps are directly reflected in trade balance, with no needs for relative price changes. Krugman concludes that, however, we have seen that there is no direct channel by which the savings investment balance somehow gets translated into the trade balance without affecting the real exchange rate. Although Krugman criticizes the statement that savings investment gaps are directly reflected in trade balances with no need for relative price changes, his argument about the twin deficits issue is incomplete, or at least not clear. Krugman explained the twin deficits by what he calls the standard view and points out that in the standard view, a budget deficit is not offset by an increase in private savings. Instead, it leads to a reduction in aggregate national savings relative to investment demand. This fall in savings leads to a rise in the real interest rate. The rise in the interest rate, in turn, leads to a rise in the real exchange rate. With home production more expensive relative to foreign, imports rise and exports fall, leading to an external deficit. So Krugman argues that budget deficits reduces national savings. And to prove his argument, he presents a savings investment identity and argue that national expenditure and therefore budget deficits are linked to national savings. But, as Krugman stressed, although an economy must respect account identities, looking at these identities can never be the full analysis. We must ask how the account identity is translated into incentives that affect individual behavior. So Krugman's argument needs full explanation of the channels through which the budget deficit reduces national savings. According to account identities, net exports and domestic output of capital goods correspond to national savings and are related to the real flow of national savings. Thus, changes in national savings are related to changes in net exports or in the domestic output of capital goods. Thus, an explanation for the channels through which budget deficits reduce national savings would be the decline of net exports due to the real exchange rate, which in turn is due to a budget deficit. But Krugman cannot advocate this proposition because in his argument, the appreciation of the real exchange rate is a consequence of a fall in national savings and not the other way around. Another explanation is that government expenditure or a budget deficit boosts growth and as a consequence imports rise and net exports fall with no needs for real exchange rate change. But it's only a possibility. Another possibility is that in the context of increasing returns, budget deficit boosts growth And as a consequence, both exports and imports rise and net exports doesn't change, and therefore national savings doesn't change. Another explanation should be the argument that budget deficits reduce domestic output of capital goods. The standard explanation is that in a context of full employment, the increase in government consumption requires a decline in the domestic output of capital goods and therefore a decline in national savings that is necessary to the increase in the production of consumption goods to attend investments, government demand. But this argument is mistaken because it tacitly assumes that capital goods intended to produce other capital goods be transformed into capital goods intended to produce consumption goods. And of course, it's not possible, except for some cases. So, although Krugman criticized the view that links directly budget deficit to trade deficit, this author doesn't go further to investigate the channels through which budget deficits and national savings are linked, and therefore his analysis is at least incomplete. In the case and perspective, investment is prior to savings, and investment depends on the interest rate and on the subjective expectation of agents about future demand and profits. On the other hand, the interest rate is determined in the context of the liquidity preference theory. As Krugman argues, the appreciation of the exchange rate is the channel through which budget deficits can worsen current account. However, the process unfolds with a different causal nexus advocated by this contribution. In the Krugman perspective, and in the perspective of many economists from the mainstream, budget deficits cause a reduction in national savings. And as a consequence, investment is constrained by savings. And that's why the real interest rate rises, and net capital inflows rise, and the real exchange rate appreciates. And as a consequence, the current account turns into deficit. But from the post-Keynesian view, it's not possible, because investment is prior to savings. So there is no... It's not possible investment be constrained by savings. But from the post-Keynesian view, we can argue that the appreciation of the real exchange rate is the channel through which a budget deficit can worsen the current account. But the channel through which it happens is different from that one advocated by Krugman. It depends, in our view, of the context of the economy, and it depends also on the economic policy. For example, in the context of full employment, a budget deficit boosts demand, and as a consequence, inflation rises and the real exchange rate appreciates. But in a context of economic slump, budget deficits boost demand, but inflation doesn't rise necessarily, and the real exchange rate doesn't appreciate. Another possibility is that budget deficits lead to a high level of government debt, and as a consequence, the real interest rate rises. But from the post-Keynesian view, it's not automatic. It's possible that budget deficits leads to a high level of government debt, but the level of the real interest rate depends on the monetary policy. Nowadays, we have many countries with high level of government debt, and the real interest rate is in a low level. So, from the post-Keynesian view, there is no systematic relationship between budget deficit and the appreciation of the real exchange rate. So, to summarize, we have the Krugman's view and our view, or the Keynesian view. In the Keynesian view, budget deficit may lead to a real exchange rate appreciation, but it not necessarily happens. Thus, the power of the twin deficits is weak from the Keynesian perspective. But if in some way budget deficit entails an appreciation of the real exchange rate, then net exports fall, national savings fall, and their current account worsens. But it does not mean that investment is constrained by the reduction in national savings. As we have seen, real exchange rate changes do not affect the beginning of the finance investment saving funding circuit. it affect the final part of the circuit, since it trigger the substitution between national and foreign savings. In this circuit, investment takes place prior to the other variables, except for the finance. Income depends on investment, and government revenues and savings depend on income. Thus, in the Keynesian perspective, even when government budget deficit affects the real exchange rate, fiscal policy is not able to lead the economy to a picture where investment is constrained by savings. Moreover, after the real exchange rate appreciation, the sum between national and foreign savings remains the same if and when the level of investment remains the same. If, in some way, government budget deficits change the relative prices of the economy, they can trigger the substitution between national and foreign savings and can lead to worsening the current account balance. Savings depend on investment, but the real exchange rate appreciation leads the stimulus from domestic investment to formation of national savings that leak abroad. Thus, the constraint on investment and on growth that is possible to emerge due to the budget deficits is one of external nature, although the link between budget deficit and real exchange rate appreciation is weak. Moreover, this external constraint on investment has a long-run character insofar as current account deficits may be financed by foreign currency in the short run. So, for conclusions, few studies in the post-Keynesian tradition address the relationship between real exchange rate, national savings, foreign saving, and investment. Moreover, there is no study that shows how the finance investment saving funding circuit and its channels work in open economies. We showed by using national income accounts and FUSF circuit to open economies that the distribution of aggregate savings between the national and foreign parts depends on the level of the real exchange rate. When the real exchange rate appreciates, part of the stimulus from domestic investment to the formation of savings leaks abroad, increasing thereby foreign savings and decreasing national savings. Finally, issues concerning relationships between fiscal policy, the current account, and the real exchange rate were addressed. Krugman investigates if fiscal policy drives the current account and concludes that the appreciation of the real exchange rate is the channel through which budget deficits can worsen the current account. However, we show that his argument about the twin deficits issue is inconsistent or at least incomplete because it does not explain why budget deficits leads to a decline in national savings when the focus of the analysis is on the real side of the economy. From the Keynesian view, the process unfolds with a different causal nexus in relation to the one proposed by Krugman and by the standard view. Although the power of the twin deficits hypothesis is low in the Keynesian view, budget deficits may worsen the current account through the real exchange rate appreciation. However, it does not mean that investment is constrained by national savings. Real exchange rate changes affect the final part of the first circuit since it triggers the substitution between national and foreign savings. When the fiscal policy affects the real exchange rate, it affects savings and the current account. But savings are the end of the first circuit, end of the causal nexus. There is, thus, no savings constraint on investment. If in some way government budget deficits lead to depreciation of the real exchange rate, the stimulus from domestic investment to formation of national savings leaks abroad. Thus, the constraint on savings and on growth that is possible to emerge due to budget deficits is one of external nature, although the link between budget deficit and real exchange rate appreciation is weak. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marco, and thank you, Mark, for inviting me here to comment on this paper. I have a great deal of sympathy with the conclusion, the spirit and the approach of the paper. My main reservation is to wonder if parts of the approach overcomplicates a little bit, with the argument difficult to follow, and it's a tough area as well. But overall, the subject is tremendously important, and Philip and Marco rightly addressed to seek perceived shortcomings in the post-Keynesian account. These shortcomings were to some extent shortcomings in Keynes's own account, though only from the perspective of written theory, not practice. I should stress that international theory, post-Keynesian and otherwise, is far from my area of expertise, in spite of a preoccupation with Keynes's international approach, which I will return to at the end. So I hope that these comments are taken in the spirit of debate rather than judgments on either the problem at hand or on Keynes's approach more generally. But my intention is to focus on two specific aspects of the paper. The first, the contesting of Krugman's twin deficit argument. And then the second, and in doing so, some discussion of the finance investment saving funding process and its extension to the international dimension. It's perhaps worth stating up front the Krugman against Marco's view, with perhaps what I regard as an alternative Keynes view at the end. Don't worry too much about this at the moment. I hope the symbols are fairly obvious. I did think in the paper that the paper was crying out for this kind of just schematisation at some point. It comes a bit late, I think. It comes in sort of footnote 12. And you could have brought it forward because I think it helps to think about it. But first, leaving aside any specific distinctions, I want to focus on the distinction between a Krugman view and a Keynes view. So the killer distinction between a Keynes and a Krugman approach, as all post-Keynesians know, I think, is that in Keynes, the increased saving comes from increased income. So that's, I put a Y up at the bottom. Because Krugman won't permit or recognise this process, he relies on an increase in foreign savings as well as crowding out. And then his process here must overlay any trade relations, and we get his story of twin deficits. So the Keynes version begins with an increase in income. And I should add that I have reservation about any deficits, let alone twin ones. Just as the increase in income would lead to an increase in saving, it leads to an increase in taxation revenue and reduced transfers expenditure. So a rise in government expenditure doesn't therefore necessarily correspond to increase in the public deficit. So I'm less sure whether the process begins with a widening of the deficit. But that's just a standard objection. Finance investment saving funding is then a tremendously valuable clarification of the domestic processes underpinning the central proposition that is the saving investment identity. I'm not sure to whom this proposition should be attributed, nor am I sure that it is common to all post-Keynesians, and I think it might be worth dwelling on this. For me, the idea of increased income generating increased savings, and moreover the idea of the saving investment identity, is very vital to the scheme of the general theory, as well as to the transition from the treatise to the general theory. And I have a quote here from a Kahn exchange with Roy Harrod, where Kahn's emphasising this process as early as 1934, and this has been extracted from Besomy's wonderful collection of the Harrod correspondence in the interwar period. But Kahn sees in the relationship between savings and investment a beautiful truism, and he emphasised four consequent truths. The first being that investment is always self-financing. Fourth, that the rate of interest cannot be determined by the supply and demand of savings. And I think these are tremendously important insights into the sort of Keynes scheme. The point of finance investment saving funding is then that it clarifies and elaborates the saving investment identity as a monetary relation affected by bank credit. And I find the specific distinction between the producer and purchaser of the investment very helpful, and I wonder if this would help your analysis as well. Plainly, Keynes and his contemporaries understood this, but the understanding was lost in ISLM, where savings equals investment is an equilibrium condition, not an identity or a fact. Now, I'm not sure who rectified this state of affairs, but I don't think it was Studart, as you put on page 3. As a footnote to your reference recognises, Davidson detailed the process in 1986, and Chick was on the case of the relationship between saving and investment and finance and credit in macroeconomics after Keynes in 1983. This relationship between savings and investment is fundamentally incompatible with ISLM, and I've find, as an aside, I find it depressing that Jeff Harcourt, in his recently issued 2011 lecture or talk, is still maintaining that ISLM is a useful pedagogical start to the teaching of Keynes, providing you stress its limitations. I don't think ISLM is helpful at all for any of this. And I'll come back to this again. But anyway, so returning to the international context, it is the point of extending FISF, or the saving investment identity, to the international dimension to show that there should be no necessarily relationship between the external position and the exchange rate. I would like to take this as analogous to the saving investment identity being independent of R. As Keynes put it in his 1933 lectures, saving and investment balance at any rate of interest, therefore any analogy with demand and supply analysis doesn't work. So in the international context, the current account is the same as the capital account independently of the rate of exchange. This is, as your analysis shows, this is a simple or complicated national accounting or balance of payments arithmetic. Any increase in the current account deficit must be matched by a surplus on the capital account. So the net flow of goods and services across a border is matched by a net flow of financial instruments in the opposite direction and corresponding flows of income. Most obviously, the US financed their ballooning trade deficit of the 2000s by issuing government debt to the Chinese. Or the other way around, the Chinese recycled their dollar surplus on the goods and services account into US government debt on the capital account. Given these flows match with consequent offsetting demands for foreign exchange, they tell me nothing about the exchange rate, and that's the kind of point of this analogy with the savings investment identity and the rate of interest. That said, even in spite of this match, is there any reason the current account might widen and or the exchange rate might change following expansion in the public deficit? In my view, this analysis should concentrate in the first instance on flows of spending, not of saving, as more in the spirit of Keynes. Really, saving has got no causal role whatsoever in the general theory, so perhaps we should, you know, think about that when we look at the international context. For me, the multiplier process begins with a fall in the rate of interest and an increase in the level of investment, or an increase in government expenditure, with leakages through saving and imports via the MPC and the MPI. I'm interested in, and to be perfectly honest, I was pretty ignorant of your view of the export multiplier, and I could see how it follows with exports as an alternative primary expenditure. I'm not sure to whom we originally owe these extensions of the multiplier theory into the international domain. I think the textbook treatment, I suspect, is owed to Samuelson, but I have a sense that we should be wary of all such Keynesian contributions, and not least ISLMBP, as not in the spirit of Keynes. So I kind of like to look beyond the Keynesian contributions. I found a 1938 paper from Colin Clark where he notes, in our analysis of the Australian statistics, Mr. Crawford and I adopted the definition of putting changes in the value of exports on exactly the same footing as changes in the level of investment, which is exactly what you've done. So it's affirmed, if you like, further back than the Keynesian contributions. But one thing that's not clear to me is whether we need the overseas multiplier and the FISF process to enable the balance of payments arithmetic and to generate the foreign saving component. Perhaps there's a distinction between current and capital imports, with the process required in the case of capital goods imports when the producer of the investment is overseas and the purchaser of the investment is at home. But this is, I offer, as food for thought. But going back to Krugman's process, an expansion in domestic demand may certainly lead to an increase in imports and hence deterioration in net exports. I think the export side of any of this kind of analysis is less straightforward. I suppose that there's reason to believe that an expansion might be common to several countries, But even if you combine the expansion, confine the expansion to one country, any expansion of exports means an increase in national income and potentially in imports. Macroeconomics isn't simple and everything's interconnected. But for me, the question isn't whether the change in the exchange rate would change net exports. And hence, I fear that Marco and Philip's paper is perhaps unduly preoccupied with this causality. But the question of interest is whether a change in net exports would change the exchange rate. And so what if it did? We've already established there's no shortage of saving, but a fuller answer, I think, demands a return to the theoretical and practical matters in Keynes. So, as I said at the start, and as is underpins all this work, on a theoretical view, it's not clear whether Keynes addressed adequately the theory of exchange rates. According to his obituary essay on Alfred Marshall, Keynes was sympathetic to a purchasing power parity theory of exchange. He sets out Marshall's most important and characteristic contributions to monetary economics. The fourth of these contributions is, and I quote, "the enunciation of the purchasing power parity theory as determining the rate of exchange between countries with mutually inconvertible currencies." So he plainly has some sympathy for this theory. I kind of wonder is whether we might be best served of thinking the parities not as an equilibrium of price, as in the so-called law of one price, but instead as an equilibrium of quantity. So the purchasing power parity exchange rate preserves the purchasing power of income from one country to another. As a result, the underlying equilibrium in exchange rates follows from countries' real output or real GDP. And then the idea provides an explanation for why countries' exchange rates should appreciate as they become relatively richer. But no doubt, too, Keynes would have recognised a role for speculation and expectations in determining of exchange rates. I hesitate to use the language short run, although I've just used equilibrium, so it's dangerous stuff. But the determination of exchange rates on an everyday basis. Is this any use? I don't know. And, you know, I just want to stress that it's just food for thought. But I do think that Keynes's practical view is unambiguous. And really, it's rarely right to consider Keynes's theory without the practical context. The backdrop to Keynes's life work was his rejection of the gold standard, and with its demise over the start of the 1930s, the instigation first of his proposed system of managed currencies, and second, aiming at his clearing union, which was, of course, watered down as the Bretton Woods Agreement. His proposals for the managed currency that was then adopted in the UK over the 1930s was based explicitly on an empirical assessment of PPPs. Volume 21 lists 62 commodities. I think they're based on a UN list of commodities, but he lists 62 commodities that could form the basis of discussion and trying to set some exchange rates that will be used. I always, when I get the opportunity, draw attention to Austin Robinson's judgments. The first one here was made as part of his obituary essay on Keynes and the Economic Journal. And again, I'm just stressing the importance of the international view. The second one was made 25 years later, again in the Economic Journal. But again, he's emphasising the same points. I mean, Keynes wanted an international regime that permitted nations autonomy to implement the expansionary policies that he saw would lead to increases in national income through reducing the long-term rate of interest and perhaps through increasing government expenditure. To protect the rate of interest, he put in place capital control. He wanted in place, and I think up to a point was successful in putting in place capital control. And this is, again, just a throwaway quote to Roy Harrod, but basically, going back right back to the start of your presentation, if the economy generates its own savings, why does it need foreign capital? The purpose of his clearing union process was to protect the exchange rate. The system would permit an elastic supply of international money that met the level of demand or income across the world and would automatically recycle any balance of payments imbalances, though there were limitations on both deficit and surplus countries. But plainly, Keynes's view was that international considerations should not inhibit international policy, although he saw that an ideal system would require institutional change. Events once more proved him correct. From the 1930s, capital control and a managed exchange permitted the expansionary policy that led to economic recovery. A rise in the rate of interest was not a consequence of expansion, as in Krugman's process. Instead, a fall in the rate of interest was a cause of expansion. While a greater extent of central control and other special arrangements, not least Lend-Lease, supported the ultimate test that was World War II, any idea that expansionary policy should lead to a rise in the rate of interest or fall in the rate of exchange was decisively refuted. The chart just shows long-term interest rates on government borrowing, and you see that the 3% war, interest rate was fixed at 3% throughout the war years on the UK line. The 3% year war was fought with sterling, seeming this is the sterling dollar exchange rate, was fought with the sterling dollar exchange rate seemingly fixed at $4.03. So Marco is very right to address these issues as unfinished and deserving work, and he's obviously very right to contest Krugman's view. I am greatly in agreement that these international processes must recognise that any expansion would generate saving. But I guess I would want to draw stronger conclusions. International considerations must not be allowed to stand in the way of expansionary policy. And ultimately, for me, it's fundamental that the broader context is kept in mind when we explore the international dimension to the general theory.